Hello and welcome to the Potential Psychology Podcast. I'm your host, Ellen Jackson, and it's my mission to share the science of human behaviour in a practical, fun and inspiring way. In each podcast episode, I interview an expert from the fields of psychology, well-being, leadership, parenting or high performance. I pick their brain to uncover what they know about living well, what tips do they have for you and I, and I quiz them about how they apply their expertise in their own life. Join me as we discover simple, science-backed ways to live, learn, flourish, and fulfill your potential. Hello, it's episode 4, and today I have with me Michelle Taylor from Blossom Tree Psychology here in my hometown of Ballarat, Victoria. Michelle is a clinical psychologist who works with kids and families. She's an expert in neurodevelopment, which is how the brain develops in kids. And I was lucky enough to see Michelle speak recently about what happens in kids' brains when they get stressed or scared or anxious. More importantly, how do we as adults help them in those situations? Michelle had some great tips that have already helped me as a parent, and I was super keen to get her on the show to share her wisdom with you too. Welcome to the podcast, Michelle.
Thanks so much, Ellen. It's great to be here.
I'm excited to have you on. As I said, I really have found just some of the stuff you were speaking about recently when I saw you speak helpful and illuminating and just given me, a different way of thinking about how I interact with my kids when they do get stressed or anxious or a bit out of sorts, I suppose. But before we get onto that, look, you have a background in working with kids who have been exposed to some pretty significant trauma over their short lives. Can you tell us a bit about the kinds of trauma that these kids have experienced and the impact that it has on their growing brains?
Absolutely. I made the conscious decision very early in my career, Alan, to really draft out a specialty in working with children who'd been abused and or neglected. So the bulk of the clients that I see and what is now very much my specialty are young people, children and young people, particularly under 10, who have been exposed to whether it be a physical abuse, exposure to domestic violence, they might have had sexual abuse experiences or experienced sort of chaotic and chronic neglect in their home life. But the other big part that kind of underlies a lot of that abuse for those kids is, you know, what I think is probably one of the most serious traumas that a child can have, and that is impacts on the quality of the primary care relationship that they have with their parents. Because often for the children that I work with, the perpetrator of the abuse is actually one of those primary care figures.
Okay.
So what that does is that erodes a young person's sense of trust and their ability to form and maintain relationships, coupled with really impacting their core sense of self as they develop and grow up. But in answer to the other part of your question, so our brain organises most rapidly in the early years of life. So from the moment of conception, our brain is starting to wire neurons, are forming connections based on intrauterine experiences. And that continues right through until around about 6 years of age, where there's this rapid process of neural organisation. The brain continues to develop throughout life. In fact, through adolescence, we go through another rapid period of myelination. And that's part of why teenagers start to become a little bit more risk-taking, and because in that during that phase of their life, their brains are developing and able to process information much more rapidly because they're getting what we call myelination of the pathways between the neurons in the brain, which allows messages to travel much quicker.
Okay.
But what we know is that if children in early childhood, infancy, early childhood, experience what we call developmental insults, so that's disruptions to, opportune developmental experiences or exposure to abuse or attachment disruption, we get dysfunction in our ability to regulate core functions of the brain. So they're things like our stress reactivity. So young people who are exposed to lots of trauma very early on will be what we call hypersensitive or have an overactive stress response. So things that you or I wouldn't necessarily react to, their little brains go, oh, no, that's really dangerous. And in the same way we would if we saw a bear in the woods in Canada. We, you know, we would have an, you know, well, to start off with, we'd have an accelerated heart rate. and then we'd work out whether or not we can fight, flee, or if we have to freeze and then decelerate our heart rate. For these kids, just exposure to novel stimuli or even just a change at school or being given a new task or a change in routine can activate their stress response system in the same way it would for us if we were exposed to something really frightening and traumatic.
Okay, so you're sort of saying that their brains are wired up to be on more on edge, I suppose, more responsive or reactive as soon as anything that might be even mildly seemingly mildly threatening to us. It's triggering that kind of what we as psychologists call the stress response system, which is, you know, how does the stress response system play out for kids? What might you see in terms of their behaviour?
Oh, in terms of behaviour, so often our stress response is a really healthy function in our brain. Like, it's designed to keep us safe. You know, I often tell parents that our brain is a paranoid organ. So, you know, it's scanning the environment for threat all the time. And what it does is it's looking for, you know, is that safe? Is that safe? Is that safe? Whoop, nope, don't know that. I don't have a template to match against that. And so then what happens is, we either have a tendency to fight, so we work out, can we fight back and protect ourselves? So the behaviours we might see there are those traditional acting out type behaviours. So, you know, you might get a kid that gets a little bit more mouthy or a little bit more resistant, or, you know, you might get the no, and those types of behaviours right up to, and it operates on a continuum, Alan. So, you know, it might start off with just general resistance and avoidance, but then it might, you know, on that acting out continuum, if the threat's big enough and the child feels, I suppose, stressed enough, or the stress gets so big that they're really unable to manage it and they're not supported and scaffolded through it, then what you get is this high-level reactivity, which can sometimes be, you know, punching, kicking, throwing chairs, those kinds of behaviours.
Okay.
Then the other alternatives are that we want to run, you know, so or freeze. And that's kind of more on what we would call a dissociative or an internalizing type continuum. And so, you know, the behaviors start off being avoidance, withdrawal, even high level compliance. Particularly in traumatized kids. So we see, and we see this a lot in young people who've been exposed to lots of domestic violence when they were very young. So they'll be highly compliant as a way to please potential people, to keep themselves safe. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, as they move up the continuum, you get increased levels of withdrawal right through to actually just checking out mentally in the room. So they'll be physically present, but it's very hard to engage them in conversation or actually even be able to talk to them because the stress has got so big that their brain has said, you know what, we just need to take care right now.
Okay.
Take care of ourselves.
Yeah, that's one of the things that I think has really helped me to understand even some of the everyday behaviour that you see. I mean, sometimes in your own kids, because, you know, everyone has kids who give you a no, or, you know, run to their room and slam the door, or will behave in certain ways that you just find, you know, perhaps a bit frustrating as a parent. But particularly watching kids when you see them in a classroom or you see them on the street, acting out, that kind of acting out, or really getting, you know, I have seen the occasional little child who just gets filled with rage all of a sudden. It's like, where does that come from? And for me, this idea that being able to kind of reflect on, you know, maybe there's something that's happened to that child. Maybe there's something that's gone on in their past that has led to this reactivity, this tendency just to kind of seemingly overreact to minor slights, which gives you a lot more compassion for the kid.
Oh, absolutely. And look, I think, you know, I guess what I'm seeing clinically more and more is we've got, you know, parents coming through who haven't necessarily in their experience of being parented been afforded great opportunities to understand their own emotions. And now we have these emotion coaching courses developed, like Tuning Into Kids, and even Circles of Security to some extent does a little bit of emotion coaching work. And you know, I think that's a sign of the times where we've now got parents who weren't necessarily well scaffolded and coached in their emotions. And so it's very hard for them to talk to their children about their emotions. emotions as well. But we also live in a society where we're incredibly time poor, where parents, you know, because of the way our world is and because of the expenses that we incur, we're generally, dual working parents. And so we're much more time poor in the time we actually get to spend with our children. So there's less of that quality time necessarily. And so I think we're often more reactive and quick to just respond and kind of dismiss or permit.
We're in a hurry. We've got things we've got to do. Quick, yeah. We're right in the car. I don't have time for your temper tantrum right now.
Yeah, exactly. And we've got, and I think also we were parented in a way that was incredibly punitive and consequence driven. And that's because our parents were from the you'll be seen and not heard generation. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so we've got these intergenerational patterns of parenting that I think have been handed down along the line. And so we do a lot of work with parents rethinking how we need to go about teaching our children, because discipline has, and Dr. Dan Siegel talks about this, discipline is about teaching, but it's become about punishment and about consequences. And absolutely, there needs to be boundaries. All children need boundaries for sure. They absolutely need to have natural and logical consequences for their actions. But how and when we deliver those consequences and how and when we do that and the nature in which we support our children so that we actually avoid having to do that is probably more important. So we talk a lot about non-traditional parenting methods now where, I'll often say to parents, this is going to sound like we're going to reward the behaviour, but really what we need to do is we need to calm Johnny down before we give him the conversation about what's going to happen. Because if we come along while he's chucking a tantrum and we do the whole get to your room, wait till I tell your father, or you're going to lose your iPad for a month, that's not going to calm him down. That's just going to move him further up that continuum of arousal. And he's likely to kick a hole in the wall when he gets to the room, because now not only is he in his room, he's lost his iPad and nothing's been resolved. He hasn't had an opportunity to calm down and talk about what it was that got him in that place in the first place.
Okay. So, and there's something going on in the brain. And I know you spoke about this the other day for kids at that point where they are, because they're highly emotional, whether that emotion is anxiety or anger or distress or upset, whatever it might be, their brain's not able to compute the kind of logical, rational information at that point. Is that right?
Oh, absolutely not. So Dr. Bruce Perry from the Child Trauma Academy in Houston, Texas, has created a really lovely little heuristic model of thinking about the brain. And so the brain's an incredibly complex organ, and what I'm about to describe is a very oversimplified kind of, description of the brain. But essentially the brain is kind of made up of four parts. And I talk to children about, we have a survival part, which is right down at the very bottom part of our brain. We have a movement and action part, which takes care of sensory processing and movement. We have a feelings part of our brain, which takes care of feelings and emotional regulation and relationships. And then we have a thinking part of our brain. Now, the thinking part of the brain is the only part of the brain that we're actually aware of. All the rest of it happens beyond underneath our awareness. And so a thinking parts of our brain takes care of our ability to problem solve, rationalize, learn new information, access our memory, all of those sorts of things. And so what happens when we get worked up, when our emotions get big, and parents can Google Dr. Dan Siegel's hand brain model and have him describe this. But essentially what happens is as our feelings get big, the thinking part of our brain shuts down. And I describe it to kids like, it's like when the modem disconnects or the internet goes down.
Could use their language.
You can't access your memories anymore. You can't problem solve. And when I'm talking to parents about it, and how I describe it to parents is, think about the last time that you and your husband or you and your wife or you and your partner had a fight, and you had 400 examples that you wanted to chuck at them of all the things that were really irking you at that moment. And, it's heated and emotions are flying high. And they say to you, give me one example. And you go, and it's right there on the tip of your tongue, but you can't grab it. And that's because your cortex or the thinking part of your brain is no longer online. The modem is disconnected and you are purely operating out of the emotional part of your brain, your limbic system. And so what you're doing instead, and what our children are doing, is they're listening to our tone of voice. They're watching the way our facial expression looks. They're not necessarily hearing the content of the words. So they're responding at an emotional level using emotional thinking in the same way we do when we get in fights with our partners. So we need to be able to think about that when we're thinking, when we're trying to talk to our kids. And I see this with parents all the time. You know, they engage in this lengthy rationalization and conversation about, you know, the behavior, and they'll ask children why, and kids will go, I don't know. And in that moment, they actually do not know.
And this applies to adults. I mean, you used an adult example there of fighting with a partner, but it absolutely does apply to adults as just as much as it does. The brains are, you know, whilst developmentally at a different stage, perhaps these processes are the same, that we just can't connect to this rational, logical part of our brain, the thinking part, when we're bound up by the emotions.
Absolutely. This is a universal human phenomenon that we all experience as we move up and down the arousal continuum.
And you do a lot of work with parents as well in the context of the families that you're working with. What would you say is kind of the biggest aha moment for parents when you describe some of these phenomena or what they're seeing from their children and why?
Well, that's a really good question, Alan. I think the biggest aha thing for parents is when you actually, when they get the continuum and how the brain works, because all of a sudden there's a logic. There's a really logical explanation for why they can't talk to and reason with their children. And then all of a sudden, those non-traditional parenting methods that we've been trying to talk about become, oh, yeah, that's easy. That makes sense. Of course I need to let him jump on the trampoline. You know, of course he can go and play Lego in his room as opposed to sit on his bed and stare at the wall. You know, and a lot of our parents are, you know, they're educated with naughty chairs in the corner or naughty mats and things like that. And, you know, none of those actually allow the child. Well, if they do, they do allow the child to regulate, but it will take a lot longer than if we let a child go and do something that they enjoy.
Okay.
And that's counterintuitive, right? Because they've just been really naughty. So we want to punish them. We want, but that's not our job. Our job is to teach them. And part of that is about teaching them self-regulation or the ability to regulate their emotions.
So if you've got a kid who is losing the plot, you know, angry, frustrated, whatever it might be, what would you recommend a parent do in the first instance when they're faced with that scenario?
Yep. So there's three things I say all the time, and if we had a dollar for every time I've said it, I wouldn't be working. Regulate the child, relate to the child, and then reason with the child. So when we're talking about regulating, we're wanting to do things that activate the reward system or make a child feel pleasure. So I'll often sit down with children and families and talk about all the things they love to do. And they come in thinking that we're going to have these problem-saturated conversations, you know, and where I'm going to talk about the problem and tell the child what they need to do correctly. And instead we talk about all the things the kids love, because it's really important to get an inventory of all of the possible interventions that we can put in place to immediately bring about a sense of calm and regulation. So we want to bring that arousal down. And what we know is that when that thinking brain is offline, when the modem's disconnected, we can't use self-talk, because the self-talk exists in that part of the brain. But we know neurodevelopmentally now and through neuroscience that if we put sensory input into the bottom part of the brain, that actually calms the bottom parts of the brain down and allows our thinking brain to come back online. So things like jumping on a trampoline, playing with Lego, having a nice cool drink on a hot day, having a hot drink on a cool day, so changing temperature, anything that taps those five senses, so sight, sound, taste, smell, touch. And then you can also do things that tap the other two senses that exist, which are more about our body in space and our ability to balance. And you can do that through dance and movement and those sorts of things. So allowing a child, you know, to have access to, you know, hard, crunchy food, for example, at a time when they're distressed, can actually be really regulating. So a nice crunchy apple will actually force the child to chew down on their jaw. Chewing gum works just as well, you know, because they've really got to activate the jaw. They get sensory input in, and that will calm them down. And I say to parents, and I, you know, I'll often, the parents that are really resistant, I'll offer it up as a challenge. Go away for 2 weeks. Give it a go. Prove me wrong.
Yep.
Because they can't, and they won't, because neurodevelopmentally and neurobiologically this works, and we know that it works. It's just about getting out of our comfort zone and thinking about the ways that we were parented and moving from, hang on a second, I need to get my child into an optimal space to learn from their behaviour, rather than actually keep them in a space of not being able to learn from their behaviour.
So it is about managing that level of emotion, calming them down, helping them to. So that was the regulating. Then step two was
relating.
Okay.
So that's where you would just be spending time with them as they're calming down. So we often do those two together in a parallel process, but not so much in face, but it might be, come on, let's go for a walk and you know, let's just go for a bit of a walk. And then that walk turns into a walk and talk because we end up at reason. So we end up with regulate, relate and reason all in the context of a walk. You know, let's sit down, have an apple together. You know, let's have a Milo. And so doing some of that stuff together, time in is always better than time out. Mm-hmm. You know, if you can bring them close and because when we put a young person in time out, especially really little ones, we're essentially further activating the stress response because we're telling them that we don't want them around us.
Yeah. Yeah, and that struck me. I think I remember reading about it a few years ago when my kids were smaller, but I still even do it with my six-year-old. If he gets very, and he doesn't tend to get angry, he just gets really upset, you know, distressed. Mm. And so I will just, you know, sit down, pull him onto my lap, kind of hold him really tight, you know, not uncomfortably tight, but just firmly and just let him get that emotion out. And it seems to work really well. And yet probably my initial resistance to that would have been, oh, look, you know, just calm down or get over it. It's not a big deal or whatever, but recognizing that this is an emotion that's really important to him, even if it doesn't seem whatever the scenario that's led to it doesn't seem like that big a deal to me and helping him to kind of calm down just by physically holding him. And then, yes, you're right. It's then he's calming down and we start having a conversation.
Yeah. Look, Ellen, the children, all our children have exactly the same emotions as us. Mm. They just don't understand them. They don't, you know, and our job is to help them understand them and help learn how to regulate them. And that can be positive emotions and different, you know, challenging emotions. And it's the thing I love about the movie Inside Out because it talks about the value and importance of every single emotion. You know, the number of children I see who think that they're not allowed to get angry or they shouldn't be scared.
Yeah.
I don't know. You know, if you didn't have fear, you would just walk out in the roundabout in front of our building and you get run over by a car. Fear's really important. He keeps you safe. You know, angry tells you that something's not right. You know, it's about not having too much of all of those things. And if we do get too much of it, how do we, you know, put anger back in his box? Or how do we, you know, make sure that anger doesn't become the, you know, the bully of the gang, the feelings gang in our brain and try and protect them all and step in and take over? You know, our job is to really help our children understand their emotional world and understand their internal world. It's probably one of the most valuable and important tasks we have as parents to afford our children those opportunities. You think about how hard our feelings are for us, you know, and so, you know, quadruple that, you know, 1,000 times over for littlies.
Yeah, well, I was just thinking as you were saying that, I was thinking, you know, there's an awful lot of adults. In fact, I think peeps even for those of us who are trained in these areas, it's still an ongoing process to be able to understand your emotions, understand the source of that emotion, be able to that experience of labeling the emotion in order to be able to kind of let it go, which I know, you know, for me has been a really personal journey, so to speak, you know, to recognize emotions that probably because of my family upbringing or whatever it might be, we've tended to kind of push down, you know, push away, don't get angry, you're not allowed to get angry, anger's bad. But recognizing and being able to say, actually, I can get angry, this is anger that I'm feeling, and if I acknowledge it, then I can kind of start to let it go a little bit or attack the source of it. So I think, you know, it's wonderful really that children are getting the opportunity to learn these things now because, you know, so much of it is so applicable even to us as adults.
Yeah, absolutely. And look, it's through that exposure to emotions, be that, so let's talk about stress, for example. But, you know, I think the experience of all new emotions is really quite stressful for children. And so through that exposure to emotions and being supported to understand them in predictable kind of moderate doses, that's how our kids develop resilience. They're not born with it. And so, you know, and we talk about stress as being a key component of that. The number of young people I see with anxiety disorders, and I'm talking under tens, you know, who would meet criteria, you know, with our diagnostic manuals for an anxiety disorder, but largely born out of the fact that they haven't had the opportunity to have regular, consistent, predictable doses to stress. And I think a lot of that comes down to, you know, again, the way that our society is made up. We're time poor, we're technologically, you know, we spend a lot of time, our kids spend a lot of time in devices, we spend a lot of time in devices, which, you know, erodes relational connections or takes away from time spent with our children, and or takes our children away from spending time with us sometimes. Mm-hmm. You know, all of those things contribute. And so young people, the ones that I'm seeing often have either been wrapped up in cotton wool, so they've been, there's like an overreaction to stress, so they or they've been not been exposed to stress, or it's been completely dismissed and minimized. So it's kind of like getting, you know, have a cup of concrete and harden up, or you know, it'll be fine, you know, don't worry about that, versus, oh my goodness, you know, that's the worst thing in the world. So then these kids are either too emotional and they don't know how to manage their emotions, or there are these kids that think their emotions are bad. And both of those strategies, as parents, we're telling our children that we can't tolerate their stress. We can't tolerate their feelings. And so then our littlies will hold their feelings in and they won't share them with us, and then they'll get this little volcano build up, and then we get explosions over time. It's really important that we can tell our kids that it doesn't matter how big or how horrible their feelings are, or no matter what they've got going on, you know, it's always something that we can manage as we're grown-ups, and it's our job. And you asked before, what's the first thing we can do? And you know, I said regulate, relate, and reason. But there's a step before that, and that is regulate ourselves, right? So our kids, when they're vulnerable, when they're distressed, it triggers something in us where we just want to protect them. We just want to keep them safe, and we don't want them to have any horrible experiences at all. And that's not helpful.
No, well, it's not life, is it? It's not real.
Exactly.
They will eventually have to have difficult, you know, even as teens, and hearts get broken, and there's failure at school and sport and various things. Yeah. Protecting them against all of that is not doing them a service ultimately. No. Although, and I think that's the key point there for me as a parent, is that all your instincts say, don't let this kid get upset, let this kid get hurt or sad. And it really does take a lot of grown-upness to be able to look at them and go, you know what, this is actually good for them. It's not the fact that they're experiencing these things, it's how we manage that, I suppose, as a family, how we talk about it.
Absolutely.
How we engage.
Yeah. And we have to, as parents, we have to park our distress at their distress. And that's for us and our partner, or us and our friends, over wine on Friday night. That's not for the child, you know. And that's where those family roles and relationships are so important, you know. And I'm often saying to children, you know, no, mum and dad have their own bubble, and it's called a parenting bubble, and you're not part of that, you know. And then there are the bubbles that involve you kids. And then mum and dad have a whole other bubble that's just them as a couple without even being parents. And all of those, you know, taking care of all of those bubbles is really important, and not letting what should be in the parent bubble spill out into the child-parent bubble. So we have to manage our distress at their distress so that we can co-regulate them through their experience, so that they can learn to sit with anxiety, sit with sadness, sit with excitement, tolerate loss, all of those kinds of things. They're all incredibly important skills that we have to teach our kids.
Yeah, and I'm just thinking as you're describing that, as parents and as adults, so it's not just parents but teachers and carers and grandparents, anyone who's involved in a child's life, we want to be able to regulate our own emotions and manage those emotions. But there will be times when it just spills out, you know. There are times, I know, when I look back, there are times, and they're not necessarily moments I've been proud of, but where I have shouted or screamed or
oh good, you're human.
Away. Yes, I'm human. and that's, I guess I'm wanting reassurance, you know, that's okay to do that.
Absolutely, Alan. And look, I often have to remind myself when I'm working with parents, because we're so often wanting to shift them to, you know, or help move them to a particular way. And teachers and carers and everyone involved with children, we're trying to shift them to a different way of thinking. And it can sound so perfect and all of that sort of stuff. And then I'll always put it together with the example where I screamed and yelled at my stepdaughter because she didn't put the tea towel in the laundry. And my husband asked me who was the adult in the room, and those types of things. things. And Dr. Ed Tronick has a lovely way of explaining this. And I just love the relief that I see on parents' faces when I say to them, the role of a parent is actually not to be in perfect alignment with your child all the time. That would mean you're there for a large extent.
Yes.
So we actually have to rupture our relationship with our child. And then we engage in a process of rupture, which leads to a mismatch or a misalignment in the relationship. And then we repair. And we should, so his statistics are that we should be matched with our kids about 30% of the time.
Okay.
And mismatched about 70% of the time, because that's when we're doing the parenting work. That's when children are having to learn to sit with your disappointment, your frustration, your anger, all of those kinds of things. But the important thing is, if we lose our cool, our job is to go in and apologize, because then we have this beautiful opportunity to model, you know what, my feelings got out of control there. And it wasn't okay for me to say that stuff to you. It doesn't excuse what you did, but I didn't handle myself very well. And, you know, I would have liked to have done it like this. But you know what? I was so angry, I just lost my cool. And I am so sorry for yelling at you the way I did. Repair.
Yeah, and that's acknowledgement of being human, isn't it? And I suppose modelling the way to do it, because the child themselves, no matter how well we parent them and teach them and guide them through this process, they're always still going to get angry and frustrated and sad and lose the plot at somebody else at some stage. So if they have a model of how to do that repair well, then that's part of the guidance.
Absolutely. And look, you know, you've heard me use the word scaffolding, and I think modelling is a big part of how our children learn from us. And then the other part is, you know, through scaffold or support. I use the word scaffold because, well, one, I'm a painter's daughter, and, you know, the scaffolding held us up.
Yep.
And I like that visual of being the parent that sits alongside or sometimes underneath, holding our children and containing their emotions and allowing them to express their emotions and explore them, kind of scaffolding them through the experience so that they don't fall into really, really unhealthy ways of coping with their feelings.
Okay. And we've spoken a lot about the emotional side of things, you know, this stress response, as we call it, so what happens to a child in terms of their brain activity and what we see, so our emotions and our behaviour as they become stressed or distressed. What are some of the physical behaviour is a physical manifestation, but what are some of the other physical manifestations that children might have? Because they're really closely linked, and I think it can be confusing to know whether we're dealing with a physical problem or an emotional or psychological problem.
Absolutely. Things that are very common are changes in sleep patterns. Mm-hmm. So you might have a child that's been, you know, sleeping okay. Now you're having trouble getting to sleep, or there's waking through the night. There might be an increase in bedwetting or a return to bedwetting type behaviour. General regressions in behaviour. So if a young person or a child has achieved a developmental milestone or an ability, and then they regress. So, you know, toileting is often a common one. Motor skills type stuff like that. Sometimes you can get agitation, what we call psychomotor agitation, you know, and it's the one that I affectionately say to parents when kids are tapping their leg in the session. Mm-hmm. And the parent says, stop that. And I say to the young person, you know, what's that doing for you? And they're like, that's helping me feel calm. And I say to them, what's it doing for you? And or the carer, and they'll say to me, oh, it's making me really, you know, annoyed.
Having the opposite effect.
So it's your problem.
Yep.
So this is what you need to do to manage annoyed, because this is helping this young person manage worry and the fact that they're in a therapist's office. So sometimes you can get a bit of psychomotor agitation. We often see what we call somatic complaints, so things like headaches, stomach aches. And the other thing that I think we often overlook, but we need to be really mindful of, and all of these things obviously need to be medically ruled out, anything that's kind of got a medical or a health kind of element to it, because heaven forbid that we dismissed it as stress and it was something far more serious.
Sure.
But one of the other things that is often very common are eczema, psoriasis, hives, kind of skin irritation breakouts.
Okay.
Yeah, so and that's because we're getting an overactive autonomic nervous system with increases in stress and emotions. So just being mindful, like if there's some sort of out of the blue skin irritations, or young people who suffer from skin irritations might have flare-ups at times of increased stress. So, okay, for example, I get psoriasis in my scalp if I am way, way, way too stressed. And so I just look like I've got dandruff, but, you know, my head will feel like I've got a decent dose of nits because I'm scratching at it the whole time. We also see, and this is, again, another thing that I think is incredibly overlooked, and not because we know about it and we're ignoring it, it's because we haven't really known about it and we haven't paid attention to it. And I think our occupational therapists in the world are now cheering with delight as, you know, psychologists and social workers particularly are starting to go, sensory seeking and sensory avoidant behaviours are really important.
Okay.
So things that we do naturally to kind of, and remember how I said before, when we are in our feelings brain or the lower parts of our brain become more active and more reactive to stress and our thinking brain goes offline, we need sensory input to calm our brain down. Mm-hmm. So our brain naturally knows to sensory seek. So we will do things like tap our leg, we will pick at our fingers, we will thumb suck, we might hair twirl, we might swivel on a chair, we might move a lot. All of the things that are incredibly annoying and frustrating to parents. But the other thing to be mindful of are behaviours that children find distressing or increase the stress response. And that's, so, you know, there might be children who struggle when they're stressed in loud environments. And so that would actually move them up the continuum and make their behaviour and their stress reaction even more extreme. So being mindful of what are the sensory things our children don't like? What are the sensory inputs they avoid? Do they struggle with, and I'm not saying every kid has sensory issues. We certainly see it in the traumatized population a lot. We see significant difficulties in sensory processing. But there can be, you know, there just can be heightened sensitivities.
Yeah.
For the general population, you know, the tags on your clothes, things like that.
I'm thinking about my own kids, and I've got, so my 6-year-old doesn't like loud noises, just gets really annoyed when we go to basketball and things like that, and there's kind of the whistles and those sorts of things. He's particular about seams in his socks, mm-hmm. you know, in the morning, yep. and the way his collar feels yeah. on his neck and things like that. He's also the one who rocks backwards and forwards on his chair at the dinner mm-hmm. table. So yeah, I think what's interesting about that for me is that notion of the importance of really observing your child and knowing your child as an individual and in terms of being able to pick up on what works and what doesn't work for that kid and that sensory thing, because it is an observational behaviour. And you're right, something that I don't think really I started to hear much about until perhaps more discussion, particularly around kids on the autism spectrum. Where there's a relationship there.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think you need to put it in context too around, you know, is my child always like this or does this come at particular times? You know, is this when we're super overscheduled and we're all running around and there's been some changes at school or there might be some issues with their peers and now all of a sudden it's popped up? It's probably stress related.
Yeah.
If it's there kind of more consistently, then it might be worthwhile getting, you know, an occupational therapist to do a sensory profile with you to determine, you know, because it's, if nothing else, it's just incredibly helpful to know what your children like and what they don't like so that you can help keep them regulated.
Yeah. 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 And at an individual level too, you know, just that whether some, I know you spoke when we were at this session last week, I think it was, about the people or the kids, I suppose, but I think it applies equally to adults who will withdraw from situations versus, you know, when they're stressed. So what we might call that kind of avoidant behavior versus the kids and adults who will react in a far more obviously emotional way. So they'll shout, yell, scream versus, you know, shutting themselves away. Because I think I've got, you know, of my two boys, I look at them and one is the, I'm going to disconnect from you and walk away versus the one who's just all up in your face having the emotional, you know, meltdown.
Yeah. And look, I think, you know, our advances in technology allow children to kind of do more of that avoidance and disconnection in ways that we don't notice because they'll go off and they'll withdraw into the fantasy of their computer games or their iPad or Minecraft. or Roblox, I think it is at the moment. And so we need to be mindful around, is this more than normal? And, you know, if we're scheduling our children appropriately, we would, you know, we'd be managing that for them quite well. And if we're observant to what kind of exposure they have to media content, what types of games they're playing, things like that, we can help control and regulate that for them. But, you know, for young people, often they'll retreat into that, those games, because it allows a way to disconnect from the world, disconnect from the stresses, and be engaged in a fantasy world. And often in a fantasy world where they can be strong and powerful and angry and in control and exert themselves in that way. Reading is another thing, you know, and reading's very healthy, but often, you know, that immersion in books. And I saw a young lad through to teenage, and he would read a book a week, and I was seeing him fortnightly. And, you know, sometimes he'd come in, he would have read three or four books in the time that I saw him. He would sit in the waiting room while I talked with his dad, and he'd be reading consistently. And he was very much on that kind of withdrawn, cut off, avoidant, compliant continuum. And there were significant issues in the relationship. And he used reading as a way to escape having to deal with the stress of that on a day-to-day basis. But his reading, which was really great for his education, was actually really unhealthy on a relational and coping level.
It was his mechanism for trying to avoid or escape from stuff that he didn't want to or didn't feel able to deal with.
Yeah. And yet in the context of a safe relationship, could put the book down and engage for 45 minutes in a session, you know, where I knew far more about his internal world than the people most important to him.
Yeah. Yeah, so it is that observation of children as individuals, and being able to know enough and be observant enough to be able to say, okay, that's normal, but that's not as normal, or that seems to be a more extreme form of the behaviour that might be signalling something to me. And what do you advise parents do in those situations? I mean, we've talked a lot about there's emotional and behavioural and even physical signs that a child might be struggling with something. What is, I suppose, the first step that a parent should take if they're concerned?
So, Ellen, can I just get clarification? Do you mean concerned around that it's at an excessive level and requires help, or other strategies that they can do before they get to that?
I don't know. That's a good question. I guess it's, you know, because I know a lot of the parents that I talk to who are parenting in an everyday kind of situation with kids who are quite normal, functional, whatever that means. But they worry, and maybe it's the overly anxious parent, I don't know, or even if I just put myself in the scenario, it's if I see behaviours that I just think, you know, like my eldest who will withdraw a little, you can kind of tell something's on his mind. So, you know, maybe a parent in that situation, what should I do?
Okay. What I might do is go through that and then talk a little bit about when to get help.
Yes, good idea.
What to look for to get help. So first and foremost, the most important thing, as I said before, is to regulate yourself. So always try and keep yourself calm. And if you can't take the time to get yourself calm before you go and intervene, it's really important. I'm just going to give a whole suite of things here in no particular order.
Things that people can try, a grab bag of things to try.
Yeah, but also things that might just be helpful as an everyday shift in the way in which you run your home and your family life. So I think it's always really important to have time where you can spend with your children, where you're calm and relaxed together. And, you know, ideally on a daily basis, where there's opportunities to relate and laugh and talk about the day and just, you know, absolutely delight in each other's company and accomplishments and in each other's being, if that makes sense.
Yep.
I think we need to be really careful about overscheduling our kids. You know, I had the luxury of growing up on a farm where I would come home from school and it will up to a certain age, because after that I had to work, but on the farm. But, you know, we could come home, throw our uniforms off and just run around acres of dirt and muck and get on horses and play with sheep and play with dogs and, you know, wander over to the neighbor's farm and catch up with their kids and ride our bikes and do all of that sort of stuff. And I think we, again, we're in such a busy society now that we want our kids to do ballet and dance and soccer and football, and all of those things are really important. But I also think we need to think about how we balance that up for our kids so that they're not overscheduled. Overscheduling our children can really exacerbate stress for them. It's really important that we listen to them when they talk to us, and we listen to their words and we listen to their behaviour. So we listen to what we see. It's also really important as parents that we keep our expectations of our kids realistic. So we all have a dream and a vision of the little baby that we're going to hold and the future that they're going to have. And for a variety of reasons, they may not shape up to be what our expectations were. That could be because there's developmental delay, there's intellectual difficulties, or they might just have a very different personality to what you expected. Lovely examples I see where really sporty dads have got computer genius kids, and there's these fractures in relationship. Because, you know, and the work then shifts from the child to working with dad around letting go of the expectation that they'd play footy together, and working with them both on finding common interests to create connection. So it's really important that our expectations are within the realms of what our child can do, and that they're not our expectations. We're not wanting to live our life through our kids, because what will happen then is we'll just, you know, if our child feels like they can't live up to our expectations, not only does it fracture the relationship, but it creates an overwhelming sense of shame in our children, that then impacts things like self-esteem and core beliefs, and then their ability to relate to others. So really important that we encourage our kids to talk about their feelings, and we do that by both direct question but also modelling it.
Yep.
But when we're modelling talking about our feelings, we also need to be really realistic about not oversharing. So, you know, the kids don't need to know about the fact that mum and dad had a fight about, you know, how the house payment was going to get paid this month or whatever. So being really clear about what we're talking about. But, you know, that was really hard for me too. Well, I really miss Nanny as well. You know, when the little ones, you know, bereft at the fact that they don't get to see Nanny anymore because she's gone to heaven.
Yeah.
Be really interested in them and their life, you know, ask and go to their activities and take the time out. You know, it's a small snapshot that we get with them. You know, but when they're 13, 14, they're not going to want to spend time with you. So grab those first 13 years and live them, like wring them dry. Because, you know, they're not going to want to hang with you again until they're in their 20s. Provide them with a safe and nurturing environment. Lots of physical activity, and do it with them. It's not going to hurt any of us as adults to actually get out and go walking with our kids at night after dinner.
I got in the pool with mine yesterday afternoon, even though I didn't want to, because I'm not a big fan of getting in the pool. But I sat there and I went, oh, well, while they're in the pool, I could do this work or I could do that. And then after a while, I thought, you know what, this, you know, I'll do a little work, but then I'll just get in the pool with them because they're delighted by it. And I actually do find that I quite enjoy being in the water once I get there. It's just the idea of getting there. But and making sure that I ride my bike with them, because I want them to see that this is what adults do, so that they continue that behaviour into adulthood.
Exactly. And look, I've got a friend, we were talking about this the other day, you know, she's really reluctant to get into her bathers with her kids because she's worried about her own body size. And I said to her, what messages are you teaching your children about body image? That they have to be a particular size? I said, get in your bathers, get out there, don't put a t-shirt on, strut your stuff, let your girls know that it doesn't matter what they look like, they are beautiful. And in the same vein, you know, when we came to find photos of my mum for a photo display for her funeral, there weren't any, because she spent her life hiding from the camera because of her weight. And I, you know, I will never do that. I will never repeat that. And I say to parents, don't ever let that happen. You know, don't live as an example for your kids around good messages. Healthy eating. So having a really, you know, one of the core staples, I said this the other night, the core staples for psychologists when we start intervention are exercise, diet, and sleep. You know, we get those three right, and then we start the rest of the work. Positive encouragement and rewards over punitive measures. So if you're parenting your child in a punitive way, see if you can shift it up. Catch them being good. In fact, make that the way you parent. Catch them being and reward them for it. Make them feel like the amazing, incredible, you know, adventurous creatures that they are.
And a lot of that reward is, it doesn't need to be tangible reward, does it? It's just, you know, I'm so pleased with the way you did that, or that just made mummy's life so much happier when you helped with, you know, putting the bins out or whatever it might be.
The best neurodevelopmental reward you can give a child is your time, your attention, your praise, your love, your relationship. Mm-hmm. You know, we exist in the context of relationships. Positive human interaction is single-handedly the most powerful reward, but it is also single-handedly the most powerful destructive force.
Yeah.
And, you know, if we can make sure that wherever possible our reward is relational-based, that is phenomenal for little kids. And then, you know, you may actually have children that do want to spend a little bit of time with you, a little bit, not a lot in adolescence. Avoid being critical because, again, that induces shame. And it's really important to monitor and media access. So, again, you know, children get exposed to lots of stuff, and we need to be really mindful of how that will impact them in terms of stress, coping, understanding, you know, and that even just includes watching the news on the other day. You know, there's so much. I don't watch the news anymore. I hear too many sad stories through the day to be able to tolerate the news as well.
Yeah, I can imagine.
But, you know, there's so much stress and trauma exposure on the news. You know, I love it when there's a good news story. Yeah. So there are things that you can do just generally to kind of keep your kids regulated, help them with their emotions, help them understand them. I think it's always really important to be mindful of where you're at as an adult. Am I more permissive of emotions? Am I going to get in there with the kids and make the emotions, make it feel like it's the worst thing that ever happened? Or am I going to be more dismissive and see if you can kind of bring yourself back to a middle ground? And if you find yourself struggling in either of those areas, it's okay. You're human. You know, take yourself off to a tuning into kids course. You know, I think Centre Care run them on a regular basis here in Ballarat. Absolutely brilliant little program around learning how to coach your children through their emotional experiences in a way that actually helps them to feel supported, but also helps you learn to regulate yours as well.
Yeah, I think this is very much, I mean, the more we talk about it, the more I'm thinking this is really an exercise in being a better adult. Being a better person as well as being a better or more effective parent or carer.
Yeah, absolutely. But when to get help?
Yeah.
So I think the times where you really want to kind of, you know, go off to your GP and get yourself a mental health care plan or talk to somebody about whether or not that's needed is when you've got a young person who's exhibiting persistent and excessive worry to the point that it impacts their day-to-day functioning.
Okay.
Yep. You know, so they're not able to concentrate at school, their grades are dropping, you know, there's nightly bedwetting when previously they were, you know, well toilet trained. You know, you're getting really chronic somatic symptoms, those kinds of things.
And does that include resistance in going to school? I know that that can be a problem that some parents struggle with, that the child just doesn't want to go and it's kind of a battle every day for weeks. Yep.
Yep, absolutely. Extreme fearfulness is another thing. So, you know, you're getting really real significant reactivity to anything that's fearful, and it might not appear fearful for you. So kind of really out of the context. Significant changes in eating habits. So they might not be as hungry, or they might overeat or binge or hoard their food in their room, those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm. And this is, again, it's on an ongoing basis. Yeah.
Yeah. Inability to control emotions. So, you know, get in the car after school, uncontrollable crying, you know, inconsolable type stuff, you know, or aggression. So on that continuum, withdrawal from friends and family. And then, you know, if we're getting into kind of older children, self-harming behaviours or suicidal ideation as well, are signs that you've got young people who are significantly stressed and need some help.
Yep.
Yeah.
Fairly urgently.
Yeah, pretty much. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's where, you know, if you've got suicidal ideation, the first port of call is our child, infant and youth mental health teams for a risk assessment, and just to mediate any kind of crisis that might be, you know, present in the moment. And then once that's settled down, then, you know, they would often refer you back to a private psychologist or another service.
Okay. And one final question. You've mentioned quite a few books and experts and various resources. Have you got any, you know, sort of easily accessible resources that parents might find? And I'll pop all of those details in the show notes as well. But, you know, one source of information that parents who have listened to our conversation today and gone, I really want to learn more about this management of my kids' emotions, for example.
Absolutely. So they've got a third one. I don't have it here. But Dan Siegel and Tina Payne Bryson have written The Whole Brain Child, which is kind of a theory book, 12 chapters of theory, really lovely. But then they followed it up with probably one of the best parenting books on the market for young children, The No Drama Discipline.
Okay, yes.
And then they currently have a new book out, and that would be one to include.
Yes.
For teenagers, Josh Shipp, S-H-I-P-P, has just released The Grown-Up Guide to Teenage Humans.
The Grown-Up Guide to Teenage Humans. What a great title.
Yeah, it is absolutely fantastic. He's got a few books out. Josh came up through the out-of-home care system, so he was a foster kid. And while he does refer to foster kids and carers, this is a really good all-rounder book for carers and parents of teenagers. Probably one of the easiest to read books. And a really lovely, helps parents understand teenagers from a very realistic perspective.
Okay, yes, which is probably where a lot of parents of teenagers are at.
yeah. And then the other one, a little bit more scientific, but very helpful in understanding how what's happening for the brain during teenage years is Brainstorm by Dan Siegel.
Okay, I will put all of those details in our references in the show notes for anyone out there who is keen to get their hands on those. I think probably the very tone of our conversation today, Shel, has been that as parents and as carers and just as adults, really, the process of guiding young people through life is an ongoing learning experience for all of us. We're never going to get to a point where we know it all or we can do it all, because aside from anything else, kids keep changing as they grow. So I found it really, really helpful as a parent, and as an aunt, and you know, another person who I suppose cares and hopes to guide young people along the journey. And I really, really appreciate all your time, your insights, and all those wonderful resources.
Thanks so much, Alan. It's been great to be able to come along and talk about what I'm so passionate about. So.
And that comes across very clearly, and I knew it would.
Thank you so much.
Thanks again, Shel. I really appreciate it. Thank you so much for listening to my long but very informative chat with clinical psychologist Shel Taylor. Shel is so down to earth but highly experienced, and she shared some really valuable insights into helping our kids to manage their emotions. I've personally learned that to best support our kids, we as grown-ups have the opportunity to learn more about ourselves and become better people. It's the essence of fulfilling our potential in order to help the next generation to fulfill theirs. You'll find all the books that Shel recommended in this episode in the show notes. Just pop over to potential.com.au/podcast. There you can also download Shel's tips and sign up to my regular newsletter. That way you'll know exactly which fascinating expert is coming up next. If you're enjoying the podcast, please let me and others know by giving it a rating in iTunes. This will spread the word about the great guests I'm chatting to and give more people the opportunity to fulfill their potential. And finally, what's coming up in episode 5? Well, I'll be joined by Dr. Susie Green of the Positivity Institute. Susie is a leader in positive psychology and positive education, helping schools to train the heart as well as the mind in education. It's going to be a fantastic and insightful interview, and I hope you can join us. Here's a little bit of what Susie has to say.
One man at the end of it, when I asked for feedback, he stood up and he said, "We never do this. We never give this sort of feedback to each other. And how good is it to do this?"
Thank you for listening to the Potential Psychology Podcast, and enjoy your week.